It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the National Assessment of Educational Progress released a report that shows math and reading skills declined among middle and elementary school students since the start of the pandemic. We'll look at the results and what we can and can't learn from these assessment tests. First, African flavors and food traditions have had a big influence on American cooking. But our next guest says those contributions haven't always been widely understood or recognized. Her award-winning book, High on the Hog, was recently adapted as a Netflix series. It traces the global history of Africa's impact on American food from before the transatlantic slave trade through today. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you watched and or read High on the Hog? Where do you see Africa's impact on American food? What questions you have about the history of these food traditions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jessica B. Harris is a leading culinary historian and expert on foodways of the African diaspora and the winner of a James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award. And she'll be talking at UW Stevens Point in Wausau today at 6 and at UW Stevens Point main campus tomorrow at 6. Both events free with pre-registration. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What got you started down this path of tracing this incredible history of African and African-American cooking?
In a word, my mouth. But it's a little more complicated than that. It goes back probably to the 1970s at that point in time. I was the travel editor for Essence magazine. And then from Essence began to make connections, the different places that I visited, tasted things. It's like, oh, that tasted like something I had last week or 2 months ago or last year. And then I started drawing lines, not only mentally, but then research lines and looking at A, B, and seeing if they connected and maybe how they went on to connect with C. And the rest, as they say, is, if not history, at least the story of my life.
And as you started doing this, you kept finding more and more gaps in the actual history, and I think our current understanding of that history when it comes to Black Americans' contributions to the food we eat today. What were the gaps you were hoping to fill in this project?
Oh, goodness. It wasn't so much as gaps as it was probably what I would call silences. I think the thing is that in many cases, things were not so much eliminated as simply glossed over. I once gave a lecture called Studying the Silences that talks about how one of the things that I learned to do was how to reread my readings of history, how to look at things sort of obliquely, how to look at the things that weren't said as much as the things that were said, and maybe through those things that were eliminated, glossed over, or just, you know, casually not mentioned, begin to make and draw and look for my history.
And a big part of the premise for your book, and I agree with it, is that we can learn a lot about ourselves and our cultures through the food we eat, how we make it, who we eat it with. Can you talk about the value of this close examination of food in particular?
Well, I mean, we're humans, and the bottom line about food for humans, at least, is if we don't eat, we die. And so it is enormously important. We have to eat. And because we have some degree of choice about what we eat, we then form our cultures around what we eat, or what we eat expresses our cultures, which is probably a better way to say it. So that old adage, you are what you eat, is never more important. We are exactly what we eat, whether we are what we eat by what is actually on the plate, or we are what we eat by what is no longer on the plate, or what is refused on the plate. All of those things contribute to the who and the why of us.
A lot of the foods you trace, some of them we might associate today with Black American food or African American food. A lot of them, I think, we see as American food without realizing some of the connections. Can you talk about daily staples in the United States like macaroni and cheese and others that have this this silence in the history?
Well, I mean, I think people are fascinated by mac and cheese. I know one of the things that I have in my house that is something that people just go gaga over is many, many years ago, I did some consulting work for Kraft Foods. And as a thank you, they put my picture on a mac and cheese box. It was never sold in stores, but I have one copy and it's framed and in my kitchen, and people just go, oh, my goodness, you're on the mac and cheese box. I think the thing is that it really has a resonance for us. It, you know, it means holidays, it means home, it means whatever the varying and various things are that it means to us, whether we are black or white or chartreuse. But I think the thing that's often forgotten is it is a dish that was popularized by an African-American chef. His name was James Hemings. He was the enslaved chef of Thomas Jefferson. He was an extraordinarily talented person. He was so talented that when Jefferson was in Paris as the ambassadeur plénipotentiaire to the court of Louis the 16th, the late Louis the 16th, I might add, he sent for Hemings to join him in Paris. Hemings did. There's a whole long story about that, which we don't have time for. But the thing is that as a result, when Hemings is leaving France, and he does leave France to return to the United States, when he does that, he is bringing some recipes with him. And among those recipes is an essentially Italian dish that he has learned in Europe, which comes to the States and becomes our mac and cheese.
Jessica B. Harris is with us, author of the book High on the Hog, which was made into a Netflix series. Jessica, speaking in Wisconsin today and tomorrow, 6 p.m. today at UW Stevens Point in Wausau, tomorrow at 6 at the UW Stevens Point main campus. You could join in if you have a question for Jessica about the history we're talking about at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jessica, speaking of things we don't have time to do, you've eaten so many foods in so many places in Africa. What were some of the foods that you ate there that, as you mentioned, really struck a chord with you as similar to things you might have eaten here in the States?
Well, I think the main thing, well, the one that was my, as Oprah would put it, aha moment, was in 1972. I was in Senegal doing research for my doctorate, and I was actually with my mother, and I had a dish called poulet yassa, or yassa ganar, and was chicken yassa. Now, it wasn't a familiar dish, but it combined a variety of tastes that were familiar, that were sort of home taste to me. It was chicken that had been grilled and then stewed. First marinated, then grilled, then stewed. So you get flavor infused in it three different ways. The chicken is marinated with onion and lemon juice, so you get that sort of citrusy thing. I happen to adore onions. The great apocryphal Jessica tale is that I used to sit on my mother's kitchen floor as a young child and eat them like apples. But so onions, lemons, chicken, it tasted unfamiliar and yet familiar. So that was the thing that sort of set off my light bulb. The other Senegalese dish, which does have descendants, if you will, in this country, would have been the national dish of Senegal, which is cheboujen. Cheb means rice. So this is a rice that is made red with tomato paste or tomato sauce and then served with vegetables and fish. Now, the dish as it wasn't something I was familiar with. But certainly the rice is something I was familiar with. The tomato paste flavoring the rice was equally something I was familiar with. And that dish goes on to become what some of us know as jollof rice. Jollof because of the Wolof Empire the Jollof Empire of the Wolof people. It goes down into Ghana and Nigeria, and they fight about it, whose dish it really is. And then it comes across the Atlantic, and here we find its descendants in things like Louisiana's jambalaya and Charleston's red rice.
Now, both your book and the Netflix series take a close look at the intersection of food and slavery, the slave trade and the realities of slavery here in the United States. Can you share a little bit of that intersection with us?
I'm not really sure. The bottom line is, for more than 200, possibly longer years in this country, what would become the United States, African Americans have been at the bedrock of the agriculture and much of the culinary, certainly in the southern parts of the United States, the agriculture, north, central, and south, it's kind of hard to grow the food, process the food, prepare the food, cook the food, and serve the food without having some degree of influence. So I'd say our influence is pretty strong.
We're talking to Jessica B. Harris, expert on foodways of the African diaspora, author of a lot of books, including High on the Hog, recently adapted as a Netflix series, speaking today in Wausau, tomorrow in Stevens Point. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of African food, African-American food here in the United States, the influence it's had? Are we talking about your family's own food traditions? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with culinary historian Jessica B. Harris. Out of two talks she's giving, one in Wausau today at 6, another in Stevens Point tomorrow at 6. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time for event info. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the history of African influences, African-American influences on American food. There are a lot of them. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller with Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I went to Chicago when I was a kid and went to Union Station, and my grandpa got me to try grits, and we tried chitlins, and I'd never tried those things before. But as a kid, I thought they were pretty cool. But my question is about shortening bread. Is there such a thing called shortening bread or shortening bread?
Yes, there is. In fact, you know the song probably. Mammy's little baby loves shortening. Mommy's little baby loves shortening bread. Put on the skillet, put on the lead. Mama's going to make some shortening bread. It is cornbread in some cases, sort of skillet cornbread. And for other people, it's almost like a tea cake. So you got a whole lot of leeway in between. But the shortening bread, I believe, is the sort of skillet cornbread.
Jeff, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We got an email from Grant who says, it seems African peanut stews are well known, but how have peanuts been used in other African dishes?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting is that we kind of think of the peanut as being native to the African continent, and it's not. It is actually native to this hemisphere. It goes early to the African continent, where it supplants something that's called the Bambara groundnut, which is another sort of rhizome, or not rhizome, anyhow, another plant that's similar to peanuts. What happens with that is it takes over some of those stews, some of those sauces, but they also turn up in marinades. They turn up just plainly on the street. I mean, one of my fondest memories of Senegal is they cook peanuts in heated sand, and the peanuts get really, really toasted and brown. They're called ngerte, and if you walk down any of the streets, you can buy a little cone of newspaper and have the ngerte, the peanuts, in them to eat.
Interesting. Thanks for emailing that question, Grant. Another silent part of the history I had no idea about, Jessica, catering, pretty common line of work in the United States today. Can you talk about some of the early African-American pioneers of what we now call the catering business?
Okay, I can, but I'm doing that tonight.
Uh-oh.
At Wausau.
Well, give us a sneak preview. You don't have to spill the whole thing.
Tiny sneak preview is they used to say in Philadelphia, if you were a caterer, if you weren't a caterer, you were kind of in the soup. But if you were a caterer, you were living high on the hog. And that's a bad paraphrasing of a quote that I will have the exact version of tonight.
Excellent. Now, I know you're looking at the history, of course, but you have hopes for what people take away from it for the modern day and the way we, I think of food. What are you hoping that people take from your book or the Netflix series and do with it in the future?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. I think the most valuable, if you will, thing about food is when we share food, we learn that we're more alike than we are different. I mean, we've talked about peanuts. We've talked about various rice dishes. So many cultures across the board, African-American and other, share these foods, these ingredients. And I think that when we start to look at what's in each other's pots, if you will, we can say, maybe not that different from me.
Talking to Jessica B. Harris, culinary historian, author of the book High on the Hog. There is a Netflix series of the same name, looking at the history of African food, African-American food, this huge influence on the United States. Go to WPR.org/Central Time, because she's talking tonight in Wausau, tomorrow in Stevens Point. Are there foods, Jessica, when you're here in the United States, you look back to your trips to Africa and you think, I wish I was eating this there with them right now?
Oh, yes, many, many, many meals. One notable one that sort of sprang immediately to mind when you started kind of in on that question is, oh, gosh, multiple decades ago, let me just leave it at that, some friends, some newly made friends who have now been my friends for more than about 40 years, I met totally by accident. I was doing an interview and at the husband's office. He is an expansive man, and said, oh, you must come home for dinner. I later found out that his wife had told him, if you bring another person home for dinner, I'm going to divorce you. So rather than have a divorce, she said, so we're going out. And they picked a place. It was called Shembay Mbarik. It is on the outskirts of Dakar on a beach. It is a place that specializes in meshoui. Meshoui is a spit-roasted lamb. And so I got to know these people for the first time, sitting in sort of beach chairs with a table in between us, picking delicate, tender pieces of lamb off of the lamb that had been spit roasted and forming a friendship. And that was my idea of a pretty darn good meal.
That sounds really good. That idea of forming a friendship. I mean, there's something magical about having a meal with someone. That's almost like a dividing line between an acquaintance and a friend. Why is that?
Well, I think it's the commensality of food. It is the sharing spirit almost over food. It is the part about sharing a meal with someone that is almost the magic, that is the part that becomes spiritual. I have a hard time eating with people I don't like. You know, sometimes business lunches are a little difficult. I equally sometimes have a hard time with eating people I don't know. But I love to eat with people simply because I find that I learn so much about them through just sitting with them, through sharing with them. And that idea of sharing food among people, sharing food around a table is important. I contend that, you know, a lot of peace treaties are signed around tables. A lot of stuff happens around tables, and I think there is something about the locus of table, whether or not it's a table in the European sense or a mat on the floor or any other variation of it. Gathering around it creates community, and that's the thing I like about sharing food.
And we've talked mostly about food today. You've written a lot about food, but you have studied and written about a lot of other things. I get the impression that you have just kind of, I don't know, an insatiable sense of curiosity. Why has curiosity been such an important value for you?
Because I'm a nosy broad, in a couple of words. I mean, I just want to know, you know. I just am curious about things. I have been fortunate to have had an extraordinary education, and it has allowed me to pursue some avenues. Why is this? How is this? What makes this happen? Who does that? Why are y'all doing that over here and not over here? All of those questions are things that I want the answer to, and so I just keep poking my nose in until I get the answer or I get smacked on the nose.
Now, for people out there listening who've gotten hungry, like I have, listening to you talk about these foods, and maybe who aren't familiar with a lot of the different foods you're writing about, can you suggest some good starting points, things that they could cook and maybe get, you know, maybe not perfect, but in the right neighborhood, maybe a little advice to try some of the foods that are part of this history?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I think that there are just so many recipes. There's so many African-American cookbooks, needless to say, my own. But there are other writers. I mean, Toni Tipton Martin has written a book called Jubilee. Carla Hall has several books out. I'm blanking on names now. There are also histories. Adrienne Miller has a history of black barbecue called Black Smoke. Library, or as a rude friend of mine says, Google you. Or, you know, do a little research, cursory research. It doesn't have to be a deep dive, but you'll find names. Go to the library. Librarians are your friend. Librarians are wonderful. They will help you. They will find recipes for you because recipes are so personal. Some people like the savory. Some people like the sweet. For me to recommend something would be, you know, crazy. I've talked about the chicken yassa. It was a good starting point for me. It might be for other people. I do a column, if I can advertise my own column.
You can.
For eatingwell.com called Diaspora Dining. I do another one for the Today Show, today.com, that is called My Culinary Compass. And for those who are still reading magazines like me, I do a third one for Southern Living that's about Southern food. They've all got recipes, too.
Jessica, thanks so much for joining us, and enjoy your time in Wisconsin.
Thank you so very much. I'm enjoying being here. I even brought a coat, so I'm good for the weather.
Excellent. That's Jessica B. Harris, culinary historian, leading authority on food traditions of the African diaspora, and author of a lot of books, including High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. It's recently turned into a Netflix series of the same name. You can hear more. She's talking to UW Stevens Point's Wausau campus today at 6. Also at UW Stevens Point's main campus tomorrow at 6. Both events are free with pre-registration. We've got a link to event info at WPR.org/Central Time. She mentioned the author, Toni Tipton Martin. Check out our archives. We talked to her about that book, Jubilee. Coming up after the news, a national exam shows students' math and reading abilities have slipped since the start of the pandemic. An expert joins us for a look at the results and what they mean, what it'll take to recover. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Republicans are working hard to win Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district as they seek to take control of the U.S. House. The mostly rural district in southwestern and central Wisconsin has been held by Democratic Congressman Ron Kind for 26 years. But it's been part of a larger trend of rural areas increasingly shifting toward the right. As Hope Curwen reports, political analysts and party leaders say the election will likely come down to what rural voters think of this year's candidates.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Hope Curwen. Republicans are fighting hard to win Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district as they seek to take control of the U.S. House. The mostly rural district in southwestern... With just a few weeks left before the November election, Democratic congressional candidate Brad Paff stops by Mahogany Dairy in rural Monroe County. As he walks the barns with the farm's owner, Gary Weber, Pav asks about his milk rotation and his feed mix.
Cows, so you've got more dry matter in here, correct?
Pav is a state senator. Before that, he served as head of the Farm Service Agency office in Wisconsin, and he was state agriculture secretary in 2019.
I mean, this is how I got involved in politics, quite frankly, is by people like Gary, just farmers. I mean, just my uncles and people in my community.
Right next to Weber's farm, a neighbor has a wagon parked along the highway that's covered in campaign signs for Republican candidates, including Paff's opponent, Derek Van Orden. The retired Navy SEAL has been endorsed by former President Donald Trump and has a passionate following on social media. Paff says it doesn't bother him to see the signs. It's the nature of the 3rd District.
But there's something that grounds us all together, that binds us all together, and that is our love for rural Wisconsin and for our heritage and for our culture.
This district was once safe for Democrats, but Trump won the 3rd in 2020, and Kind only narrowly beat Van Orden that year. Kind's retirement ensured the district would be one of the GOP's top targets this year. Now, a growing number of signs suggest the race is slipping away from the Democratic Party. A national election predictor recently changed their rating from leans Republican to likely Republican after a Democratic PAC reportedly canceled TV ads for PAF. Political scientist Anthony Chergosky from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse says PAF has faced tough odds from the start of the election, needing to energize voters in Democratic cities and hold his own in rural communities. And the district is not alone in seeing communities that were once purple become more strongly red.
Right now, Democrats are not even holding their own in rural Wisconsin. They're getting completely wiped out in rural parts of this state.
Republicans have appealed to voters on cultural issues, painting Democrats as out of touch with the realities of rural people. This has been a major part of Van Orden's campaign. Van Orden's spokesperson declined a request for an interview with the candidate. On social media and in campaign ads, Van Orden has highlighted his military service, stressed the impact of inflation on voters, and labeled PAF as just like the Democrats in D.C.
Prices, higher groceries, just about everything. Brad PAF, he backed Joe Biden 100% of the time. That's what you get when you spend your career in politics. Well, it ain't me.
Brian Westrate is former chair of the 3rd District Republican Party. He thinks voters aren't impressed with PAF's career working for government agencies, and they're looking for someone who's more relatable.
Derek has, you know, had a career serving his country in the military, and then has since then been a small businessman and a volunteer and worked in the private sector. And there's just a clear contrast there.
PAF has hit Van Orden on his stance against abortion and for Van Orden's attendance at the Trump rally that eventually became the January 6th insurrection. Chergosky says PAF has also embraced a more patriotic message and tried to connect with voters on rural cultural issues. Chergosky thinks it's rhetoric that does resonate with voters in the region. But some rural Democrats say one candidate isn't enough to turn around the party's reputation outside of the state's largest cities. Sean Murphy Lopez is a Democrat from Richland County who ran for state assembly in 2020. He branded himself as Rural Sean, complete with a campaign ad filmed on his farm. He lost the race. But Murphy Lopez thinks it was because of discontent with national issues, like COVID-19 restrictions and the sometimes violent protests after the murder of George Floyd.
They look at those letters behind the names, you know, and they say, in general, I think I support the Republicans right now more than I do the Democrats.
If Democrats want to change that, he says they'll need national figures who return to a message that speaks to working people. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, released a state-by-state report Monday that shows math and reading scores have dropped since 2019 and the start of the pandemic for 4th and 8th graders. Some of the key findings in Wisconsin, the state saw declines in all four categories, as did all states. The state is in the top 10 overall in outcomes in 3 of the 4 categories. And a longstanding racial divide in Wisconsin is still there, with once again the biggest gap between black and white students in test results, though some states didn't release that kind of data. Our next guest says the exam confirms what we already knew about the impact of the pandemic, but he's worried about an overreaction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed your child's learning rate changing during the pandemic? If you're a teacher, how's your teaching changed, if at all? Are things getting back to normal in schools for reading and math? If you're a teacher, student, or parent yourself, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Harry Fader is a retired teacher and executive director of Fair Test with the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. Harry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, you emailed before this test came out. You put out a statement saying we're expecting some declines, but we're worried about an overreaction. What kind of concerns did you have?
Well, obviously, the results of the NAEP are not good. Nobody's happy with them. Mm-hmm. But my concern is really, and our concern as an organization, is that these results don't set off alarms and panic buttons that cause schools and school districts to say, hey, what we need to do is to actually test kids more. And so what we're concerned about is that it will be used in it as an excuse by those forces who simply wants to constantly monitor student progress in a way that is not helpful at all for the actual educational growth and development of students. Because what students need is learning time, not testing time.
Yeah, let's talk about the tests, the use and maybe misuse of them. First of all, something like this National Assessment of Educational Progress, it is a there are no stakes here for an individual student, as I understand it. I don't need to pass this to go to the ninth grade, for example.
Right.
Is this kind of test a useful benchmark to see how things are going in our schools?
Oh, yeah. We have no objection to the NAEP per se. For a variety of reasons, as you yourself stated, there are no high stakes consequences attached to these tests. So we can get a picture of what's going on in schools without punishing and penalizing students, teachers, and schools. And yet we sort of get a window into how students are progressing, how learning is going. The other thing about the NAEP that's a positive, it's done on a sort of matrix sampling basis. So not every kid sits for the test. It's just sort of a representative sample of students of different demographic groups in different parts of the country. And you can also compare states. And, you know, in this round, you could also see how big cities are doing, because there's a sort of a program that looks at how big cities are doing. So NAEP as sort of a light into what is going on in education is fine. The problem is when you have standardized tests that are given repeatedly at every grade level that and then also are used for promotion, for tying it to teacher performance pay, all sorts of high stakes consequences, that what winds up happening then is you wind up having teachers and systems teaching to the test, which is no good. And also it actually like cuts in on time. But NAEP as a window into what's going on, I mean, it's a pretty good system.
We'll spend a little more time on the downsides of over-testing, but with something like the NAEP, this national assessment, what are you hoping we do with this information, whether it's a normal year, if there is such a thing, or this kind of abnormal period, you know, after, you know, a couple years after schools were just flat out closed in many cases and virtual learning during the pandemic?
Right. Well, I think we can, first of all, take a look at different places in the country and see, you know, why some places might have done better than others. So, for example, in this go round, you know, scores went down a little bit, but LA did relatively held its own. And so, you know, what can we learn from what Los Angeles did over the last couple of years that distinguished it from some other places? And, you know, it turns out they had a pretty robust system of trying to get laptops to kids. You know, they were trying to sort of do online learning in a little more robust fashion and invest in professional development. The superintendent there, Alberto Carvalho, you know, the district he left, which was Miami, actually didn't do so bad either. So, you know, maybe there's something systemically that they're doing that is worthwhile. So, you know, NAEP itself, the raw numbers don't tell, they tell you whether things are going up or down. And, you know, if you look at certain items, you can see what percentage of kids responded, you know, got an item right. So that gives you sort of a little window on the kind of learning that's going on. It also, as the beginning of your piece showed, with respect to Wisconsin and around the country, it also certainly tells us where the disparities lie. And so, here, the other thing that happened is the lower performing kids actually nationally, their scores went down more than the higher performing kids. So that tells us that we need to sort of focus on where the gaps are, where the inequities are, how to funnel resources and teaching resources and learning resources and curriculum and sort of extra enrichment programs. You know, people are talking about concentrated tutoring, which if done well, can be a good thing. But, you know, tutoring from somebody who isn't your actual teacher, that doesn't always work necessarily. For certain things. So, I mean, I think the lessons that we want to draw, and the other broad lesson is obviously in-person learning matters. because the disruption of not actually being in school for fourth graders and for eighth graders for over a year certainly did something that was out of the ordinary in terms of test scores.
We're talking to Harry Fader, Executive Director of Fair Test with the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, looking at a report released by the National Assessment of Educational Progress that shows students' math and reading abilities went down, according to the test, since the start of the pandemic. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this happening in your classroom, in your family? And how about testing? Do you feel like if you're a parent, a student, you work at a school, there's too much standardized testing of one sort or another? This NAEP, this NAEP, is just one test of many out there. Are we getting test clog in our schools? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Harry Fader, Executive Director of Fair Test with the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. With us to talk about an exam from the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It shows a decline in students' math and reading abilities. That's one test. There are lots of tests out there. Maybe, he says, too many. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to these results, your concerns about how we do standardized tests in schools. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Harry, the NAEP, as I just said, it's one test. How many tests are kids, standardized tests, are kids going through as they go through their school career?
It depends on the state. There's certainly, there are federal mandates that said kids have to be tested in reading, math, and science grades 3 through 8, and then at least once in high school. And then a lot of states have lots of other tests. There's also now a move towards doing something called through-year tests, which are generally produced by testing companies and are sort of online, computer-generated, iterative tests that try to give educators a sense of sort of where a kid is. I think there was a statistic that by the time a kid graduated high school, they've taken 170 different standardized tests during their educational career. So, we as a country, with the advent of No Child Left Behind, even though that has sort of been scaled back because that was an abject failure, kids are tested with external instruments. And frankly, there are a lot of better ways to measure kids' progress and to see how they're doing and how they're learning. Teachers give tests all the time to see. They give a little quiz. They give a test at the end of a unit. So I'm not even counting that stuff. I'm talking about what we would call standardized tests that are produced externally. There are also ways of assessing kids' knowledge. We call them performance-based assessments, where kids will do a project or a presentation. They'll have to collaborate with other kids, and the assessment will be tied to what is actually being learned in the classroom and also demonstrations of certain skills. And, educators have developed what we call rubrics to judge how well a kid is doing and what skills have been demonstrated. And, there are places around the country, both at the lower school level and at the high school level, where this kind of assessment is not only it's viewed as superior because you really get a more holistic picture of what a kid knows as opposed to a pencil and paper test. But it really allows for kids to develop skills of critical thinking, of speaking, of analysis, and in fields like math and science, of actual problem solving, of math problems. In science, of actually doing experiments and learning the scientific method and not just sort of memorizing things and regurgitating them. So, there's a lot out there in the realm of assessment that I think our educational systems are hopefully moving towards and, realizing that there are better ways of knowing what kids know and the skills they have than off-the-shelf standardized tests.
Let's go to our callers now. Doug is with us in Portage. Doug, hi.
Hi. I'm retired now. I spent 25 years of my professional life as a chemist, and then I switched over and became a high school science teacher and did that for about 15 years. And so I want to speak specifically about the ACT science test, because parts of it are wonderful, but the overall thing of it is ridiculous. The parts that are wonderful is it is gauged where I would want a student to be, the type of knowledge that they should have by the time they're turned loose from high school. Actually, it's geared where they should be at in ninth grade, because we don't know how if kids took advanced anything.
Gotcha. Doug, what's the ridiculous part?
They do 40 questions in 35 minutes. What we have
there
to
you
do
go.
To try to get the kids to have a chance to pass it is tell them, don't read the text, because they're given a text and then questions on it. Skip to the questions and then go back and find the pertinent information. It will usually tell you what chart to pull it out of.
Doug, thanks for the call. And the ACT required still, I believe, for 11th graders here in Wisconsin. Your thoughts, Harry?
Well, it's interesting. Is the ACT, and I just don't know, being used in Wisconsin as the high school requirement under federal education law, under ESSA, because a lot of states use ACTs or SATs. They basically just give it to kids because that is the how they fulfill their ESSA requirement. So that may be the case. I know that the Wisconsin state system, certainly University of Wisconsin, is a test optional school. And so you can apply and get in there without submitting an ACT or SAT score. You know, it's interesting what Doug said about the ACT science. I mean, I've looked at it, and obviously the speed at which you have to process things and do things, that's not about science, that's about test taking. So I agree that it is abjectly ridiculous. Also, you know, I would submit that there are better ways of knowing whether a student understands chemistry and understands science. I mean, you could, and as I was referring to, you know, have them as a culminating activity, come up with a hypothesis, conduct an experiment, in addition to sort of having them demonstrate that they understand concepts in chemistry and write about them and speak about them and present them. And, you know, that certainly would tell you more than 45-minute, 60-question standardized test.
Doug, thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I myself took the ACT, SAT, and many other standardized tests for college entrance. And I will say I'm open to or excited to hear about new testing, but please replace an existing one instead of adding it on top. For
Jake,
me personally, my parents took a lot of money out of their, you know, pockets to pay for tutoring and books, and that stuff's not cheap.
Jake, thanks for the call. Jake, Harry, that general philosophy, if you're adding tests to the equation, take something away. What do you think?
Well, I would take away what's there already. I don't think we need to, we certainly don't need to add, and I think there are too many and they're being used badly. I think there, as I've said, there are better ways of assessing student knowledge and skills. And, you know, just something that Jake talked about was his parents spending all this money, you know, for tutoring programs that are completely external to the regular public school or even private school curriculum. And just imagine your parents maybe scraped to do that stuff, but there are a lot of kids out there who can't afford that kind of test prep. And that's why there is a very, very serious equity problem presented by the ACT and the SAT as requirements. And if you look at the College Board's own data, there is only one thing that SAT scores correlate to, and that is family income. So you tell me if that's a good way of admitting kids into college.
Jake, thanks for the call. And Harry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
That's Harry Fader, Executive Director of Fair Test with the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, looking at new national test results and the value or lack of same of some standardized tests. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, take a trip to music class. Check out the State of Music Education in Wisconsin. Join in with your questions and experiences tomorrow on the Ideas Network. There may be a new world record for the longest ever direct flight by a bird, as far as humans have observed, clocking in at 11 days and 1 hour, covering over 8,400 nonstop miles. The Puko Rokoru Miranda Shorebird Center in Tasmania shared the initial report yesterday. The bird is a bar-tailed godwit. I've talked about these birds on the show before. They make these incredible nonstop journeys from Alaska to Australia and New Zealand. 7,000-mile trips across oceans, the Pacific, are pretty common. This one, a juvenile, skipped a chance for a layover and beat the previously held record. The bird is known as 234684. It was tagged in Alaska, set off on October 13th, made its landing yesterday. New York Times Science Section did a write-up on the godwits. Quote, their internal organs undergo a strategic restructuring before departure. The gizzards, kidneys, livers, and guts shrink to lighten the load for the trans-Pacific journey. I'm guessing they never ask, are we there yet? Bird news you can use. This is Central Time.